From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is North Korea backing down? Hello again, I'm Armin Altney, and this is To the Point. Kim Jong-un now says he won't send four missiles toward the territory of Guam, apparently easing the threat of nuclear war, at least for the moment. That comes in the aftermath of President Trump's threat to rain fire and fury on North Korea, backed up by U.S. military leaders. Next up, the U.S. and South Korea still plan annual military exercises later this month, regarded as hostile by both North Korea and China. We'll ask former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and others if tough talk and that kind of action are working. Later on today's Talking Point, is it okay to dox a Nazi? We'll hear what that means and get some answers. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Kim Jong-un says he won't implement his plan to target missiles near Guam. Is that the result of President Trump's tough talk? Former Defense Chief Leon Panetta says it's not time to declare victory yet. We'll talk with him and with others. On today's Talking Point later, since the violence in Charlottesville, social media users have been trying to identify photos of white supremacists and out them on the Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The idea is that racism should have consequences. But what happens when so-called doxing IDs the wrong people? We'll talk to a man who's been at it for almost 20 years. First, this news update. Yesterday, the black CEO of Merck and Company resigned from a White House business group that advises President Trump. Without mentioning the president himself, he appeared to be condemning the failure to condemn racism in stronger terms. He has been followed by the CEOs of Under Armour, Intel Corp, and the president for the Alliance for American Manufacturing. President Trump has tweeted that they are grandstanders. Jeff Green reports for Bloomberg on management and diversity. Jeff, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what appears to be the case here? Did these business leaders get pressure to do this?
There's lots of pressure right now, not just for these CEOs, but for others. Kenneth Frazier is an exception. He seems to have made the decision on his own and sort of set the tone. But then as soon as that happened, the folks who had been pressuring people to quit the council came out in strength. And you could really see it, Kevin Plank and Brian Kesnick's their Twitter pages were really lit up with people saying, you know, join him, show him that show the same support, don't be a hypocrite, that kind of thing, and that's continuing today.
Kenneth Frazier of Merck is, of course, the only one so far that's African-American.
Yes.
What is the organization that they are leaving?
Well, they're leaving. There's a couple different sort of informal business councils that the Trump administration put up, but they haven't really met. So that is a good question. There seems to be one on manufacturing, one on strategy, but they're not sort of something that's like a group that's been meeting regularly so you can kind of see how they work. It's something that they said they were going to use to bring input into the administration. And one of them was on jobs and one is on broader business strategy. And the companies that are saying manufacturing jobs are important and they want to have a seat at the table for this discussion.
The president not only called them grandstanders, but he also said, essentially, I can get any CEO, I can get more CEOs whenever I want them.
Yeah, he did.
What does that do to the reputation of the organizations and the usefulness of them to the White House?
Well, so far, there hasn't been anyone else from any of the major companies who've joined them, but you can see the pressure today on social media and elsewhere for more of these public-facing companies in particular to sort of join the CEOs have already left. And keep in mind that Disney and Uber and Tesla have already left for disagreements with the president on pass policy.
Now, what does this do to the president's reputation as a former businessman? There were a lot of people in business who looked forward to his presidency because of his background.
Yeah, that is the question. Is it, you know, this is the CEO president, and he seems to be willing to attack those CEOs pretty much at will if they don't agree with him, which is one of the things that the detractors are throwing out there, is if he's not going to listen to you, then what's the benefit of having a seat at the table? You're just enabling him and making him look like you're legitimizing him without him actually having to give you anything in return.
Really throw some doubt then into the usefulness and the importance of the organization they're quitting.
Yeah, and one of the professors, a lecturer we talked to from Stanford, raised the issue that if these CEOs joined this council without an expectation there would be controversy, maybe they made an error there, that this is the kind of thing, all these positions that he's taken, he has taken in the past, including a reluctance to distance himself from white supremacy groups. Therefore, none of this should have been a surprise, and maybe they should have calculated a little better on what might happen if they did decide to join. Of course, that was, you know, what happened in Virginia is not something anyone could have predicted, but the general themes are not new to Trump.
In the very brief statements that some of these executives made, they used the word politics and said they don't want to be in politics. What did they want then if they were going to ally themselves with a president and advise him?
Yeah, I mean, that is sort of the question that's still out there. Is that there was a hope, I think, that they would have the ability to influence policy, but it's not clear if that is going to happen, especially when, you know, what happened, he was so quick to attack Kenneth Frazier after he left, even before he had responded, which is what Kenneth Frazier was asking him to do.
Frazier, of course, once again, the only African-American so far who has left. Is there any diversity left on the council?
There are several women who are under pressure to leave, Pepsi and at Campbell Soup. General Motors CEO Mary Barra came out today and said she will stay, but there's a lot of pressure on the social media for her to reconsider. But the diversity, there wasn't a hugely diversity group in the first place.
And as a businessman, Donald Trump wasn't described as a champion of diversity.
No, I mean, he said that himself, but that wasn't sort of his reputation.
Sure. Well, he did what he did, and now he is apparently getting the consequences of something he didn't control, but which he has not obviously reacted to in a way that has been politically satisfactory to a lot of people.
Right. I mean, when he did react, that was an interesting scenario. Is at least one of the CEOs quickly sort of quoted his response in their response and saying that we should all stand together with the president and oppose these sorts of acts. But it did come, you know, after this had already happened.
Okay. Jeff Green again, reporter for Bloomberg. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In a moment, we'll hear about North Korea and the situation with regard to nuclear war. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Last week, President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un were exchanging threats that raised the possibility of nuclear war. Now, Kim Jong-un says he is not ready to fire 4 missiles at the island of Guam after all. Leon Panetta was chief of staff to President Bill Clinton. He led the CIA and the Defense Department during Barack Obama's administration. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to our program.
Nice to be with you, Warren.
You said last week this was the closest we'd come to nuclear war since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Has that threat now been reduced?
Well, we'd like to hope so. It certainly seems like both sides are kind of pulling back from the brink here. We've had the national security team for the president all saying that war was not imminent and are making efforts, obviously, to reach out and see whether there's a possible peaceful solution here. And obviously, North Korea seems to be hesitating in terms of proceeding with missiles to Guam. So, you know, perhaps we're in at least a hiatus here that might give both sides, hopefully, a better path towards resolving this issue.
We don't know that North Korea could fire a nuclear weapon or that he could hit it, that it could hit a target. We do know that the U.S. has more nuclear weapons than any other country. Who worries you most, Kim Jong-un or President Trump?
Well, that I think that's what has concerned me and makes this particular crisis different than what we've seen in the past. Because we've had both leaders taunting each other and threatening each other, and obviously our president talking about fire and fury and lock and load. And when you engage in that bully and counter-bullying tactic, what it does is it raises the temperature on both sides and creates the danger of a miscalculation. And that's always been the danger in Korea, is that one side or the other may miscalculate, may make a mistake, and suddenly you find yourselves in a shooting war. And so that's the danger I see in what's gone on these last few weeks. And the hope is that we can pull back from that kind of intimidation.
Kim Jong-un has backed down. There are those who are saying this is a great victory for President Trump, that the bullying, as you call it, worked. What do you say to that?
Well, it's a little early to claim victory here, because the bottom line is that North Korea still retains their missile capability. They clearly have developed an ICBM capability. How good it is still remains to be seen. They've got anywhere from 20 to 30 or 40 atomic weapons, depending on whose intelligence you rely on. And so North Korea still remains a very real threat. And we have not proceeded to try to see whether or not there is a path to resolving this issue. Essentially, we're at a stalemate. We're at a checkmate. United States knows that we have the power to end that regime. But North Korea also has the power to devastate South Korea, and particularly Seoul, a city of almost 30 million people. So we're still at a stalemate, and we still haven't found a way to try to resolve this crisis.
Even if we do have diplomatic relations with North Korea or a diplomatic exchange, will the U.S. simply have to accept that it is a nuclear power like Pakistan and India, since North Korea considers this to be an existential question?
Well, that goes to the heart of whether or not there is a path here to resolve this issue. I think some have suggested of the possibility of a freeze on their missile development and on their nuclear development, and yet the concern is that a nuclearized North Korea remains a very serious danger with this leader, who is uncertain and unpredictable, and could at any moment make use of those weapons. I mean, the history of the relationship with North Korea is a history of provocation and accommodation. There's been long periods of provocation where they've threatened to do this or that and have taken actions of one kind or another, and then there's a period of accommodation. And I just think that what we have to determine is whether or not we're just going to develop another short-term answer with North Korea, or whether we're going to try to put North Korea on a path towards denuclearization and greater stability. I don't know the answer to that, but I think ultimately, if we really want peace in that part of the world, we're going to have to do more than just freeze their capability.
Later this month, the U.S. and South Korea are planning their annual military exercises in that region. That is considered hostile by both North Korea and China. We're depending a lot on China. Should those exercises be stopped or postponed or reduced in size to ease the tensions?
Well, I certainly wouldn't postpone those exercises at this point. We haven't gotten anything in return. And unless it's clear that North Korea is prepared to sit down at a negotiating table and, in fact, begin negotiations to try to resolve this issue, I would not do that. I think the key right now is to try to enforce the sanctions that have been put in place by the UN China is a big player in terms of making those sanctions work, so we have to determine whether China is serious about implementing those sanctions. I would even consider the possibility of ratcheting those sanctions up. I do think that the sanctions, particularly with the kind of economy that North Korea has, can have an impact there. We have got to be able to make very clear that we are not going to capitulate without something being shown by North Korea that they are willing to, in fact, try to resolve this issue peacefully. If they're not, we've made very clear that our policy is one of containment and deterrence. And if they do provoke us or they do try to attack us, it would spell the end of their regime. I think that's the message we have to keep sending.
In addition to your many other jobs, you were a chief of staff to a president. How concerned are you about the chaos in the White House that we hear about? And do you think that General Kelly can maintain order?
Well, I know John Kelly. He worked for me as a military aide when I was Secretary of Defense, and I have a great deal of respect for him. I think he's trying to be able to put some semblance of discipline in the operation of the White House, and I'm sure he will be successful at trying to do that. But the real concern is, can he discipline the President of the United States, and whether or not he can develop a process for policymaking that makes sense, rather than having a president who goes off on a tangent and tweets and makes comments that that frankly everybody else has to backfill and try to correct in the days following those comments. I think the real test of whether or not he's going to be successful is whether or not the president ultimately recognizes that he's going to have to change the way he does business in the White House, and that, to me right now, looks like a long shot.
Leon Panetta, former White House Chief of Staff, former head of the CIA, former Defense Department Secretary, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
We talked with Leon Panetta a few moments ago before we came on the program. Here is the latest policy statement from Vice President Pence.
Successive administrations in both political parties have believed that negotiation and patience with North Korea would achieve the long-term objective of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That has utterly failed.
Gordon Chang is expert in East Asian economic and security issues. He's also author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World and the Coming Collapse of China. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Do you agree with what we just heard from Vice President Pence, which seems to be that we need to get tougher than we have been, certainly talk tougher, as President Trump has been doing?
Well, the sanctions on North Korea may be the strictest yet, the ones that were adopted this month, but they are hardly severe because they allow North Korea to earn significant export income. And indeed, we're not even talking about the Iranian payments to North Korea of somewhere between $2 and $3 billion a year. But the one sanctions that can have an effect are not really the ones on North Korea, but sanctions on China for support of North Korea's ballistic missile program, its nuclear weapons program, and indeed sanctions busting. And I think that as we look at, for instance, the money laundering by Chinese banks, we have an inconvenient truth, and that is China's not a partner on this, but is indeed a bad actor. And we can make China a partner, but only if we put such pressure on it that it has no choice but to comply. So sanctions haven't worked, but then again, we haven't really tried sanctions. We haven't really gone where we need to go in order to move both North Korea and China in better directions.
The president said today that he wants to take trade actions with regard to China, and spoke again, as he has in the past, about how China is stealing from us. Is that moving in the right direction?
Well, it's moving in the right direction, but certainly not fast enough. So, for instance, yesterday with the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer next to him, he said that he wants to have an investigation into whether an investigation into China's intellectual property theft is advisable. Well, we don't need an investigation into an investigation. What we need are trade remedies for, you know, stealing somewhere between $250 to $600 billion a year of U.S. intellectual property by China. So we have to go much further in that direction. And indeed, IP theft is only one of a number of severe Chinese trade violations, which have gotten worse since Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has become in power. His Made in China 2025 initiative is deeply troubling. And indeed, a whole new raft of cybersecurity and national security legislation and regulations also deemed, look like they are not compliant with WTO rules, World Trade Organization rules. So there's much that we need to do here. You know, China has been a trade criminal, but on the other hand, that's not the story. The story is that the United States has not enforced its trade rights against China for decades. And so, of course, the Chinese are going to take advantage of that. So this is a story of America's failure to defend its workers and its businesses.
Let me turn to Julian Borger. He is a World Affairs editor for The Guardian. And, Julian, thanks for being back on our program.
Pleasure.
The U.N. Security Council has issued sanctions. Gordon Chang says they're not severe enough and not doing the job that they need to do. What about the, if I can put it this way, the rest of the world looking on at this situation, a very scary talk going on between the U.S. and North Korea? And is there a general agreement that, as we heard from Vice President Pence, there has been too much accommodation in the past and that it hasn't worked?
Yes, I think there's general agreement that the policy up to now hasn't worked in terms of stopping North Koreans carrying out missile tests. So far, there hasn't been a nuclear test for some time, although another one is expected. But there is disagreement about the way out of this puzzle. The obvious answer is to get China to do more, but China has mixed motives. On one hand, China doesn't want to see nuclear and missile testing and destabilization from North Korea. On the other hand, it doesn't want to see a collapse of that regime, and it is nervous of triggering such a collapse if it turns the screw too hard. But there are signs that it's going to take these UN sanctions more seriously. It said yesterday it was going to cut off imports of North Korean coal and iron ore and some other goods over the coming weeks. And that is tougher talk, and we'll see if that's tougher action in the wake of this latest UN resolution.
Gordon Chang, back to you. We heard earlier from Leon Panetta that there is a real concern about miscalculation that could lead, as he put it, to a shooting war. How concerned are you about that as the tensions rise?
I think everyone has to be concerned about miscalculation. For the last week, we've heard, as Secretary Panetta said, some pretty tough words from the President of the United States. They very well have moved the North Koreans to a better place, but I'm not so sure, because perhaps this whole issue of the Guam salvo of four missiles maybe was planned by Kim Jong-un, that he was actually planning to create the tension and then to bring it back down. And the reason I think that that very well may be the case is because a number of people have been saying that if we can't deter Kim Jong-un, we're going to have to disarm him. And maybe what Kim was trying to show is that he is deterrable so that we will allow him to keep his arms. So, you know, I'm not so sure that the rhetoric from the president had an effect. It very well may have. But on the other hand, maybe the Kim regime was playing mind games with us and engaging in some very subtle diplomacy to make sure that we did not interfere with their weapons programs.
Julian Borger, once again, this is thought to be an existential question by the North Koreans. They look at Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, who gave up his nuclear weapons and ended up having a sad end. Is there some understanding of that around the world?
Yeah, I think there's widespread acceptance. So certainly, I would say in Europe and probably, you know, South Korea and Japan, that the end result of negotiations, if and when they happen, may not be that North Korea gives up its entire nuclear weapons program. The question is whether you go in on negotiations on that understanding or not. And Secretary Tillerson has suggested that that would be a precondition, the acceptance by North Korea, whether it was going to accept that as a precondition. And that's
okay, I'm going to interrupt you at that point. We do need to take a break. We'll come back in a moment on our talking point. Is it okay to dox a Nazi? We'll hear what that means and get some answers on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. North Korea appears to have backed down from the threat of sending missiles in the direction of Guam. We've just heard from Leon Panetta, the former Secretary of Defense, that it's too early to declare victory as yet. Gordon Chang has been with us. Once again, he's an expert on China and that region. He appears often on CNN and on Fox News, and he's author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World and the Coming Collapse of China. Gordon Chang, I know you need to leave us very soon. Do you feel significantly better today than you did yesterday with regard to the possibility of there being an outbreak of some kind involving North Korea?
Actually, I don't. And for the reason that Secretary Panetta said, that really nothing has changed. The North Koreans still have their weapons capability. They can test at any time. And, of course, the United States has a time frame in mind because we believe that within a year or so, they'll be able to land a nuke on American soil. And so that creates a sense of urgency in Washington that we haven't seen for quite some time. And that creates a sense that there's little margin for error. And so we have the preconditions for a really big bust-up. And the question is, are we going to solve them? And I think it's going to be very difficult because North Korea and China have interests that are mutually incompatible with those of the United States and our friends and allies. And at some point, they've got to be resolved. I hope they can be resolved peacefully. I think they will be. But nonetheless, there's going to be a lot of tension, friction, and noise before we get to that point.
Even if North Korea could do what you say and drop a nuclear weapon on the United States, there's no question that the country would be eliminated if it did that. Is there good reason to believe that they really might do that if they get the capacity that they're looking for, or are they just trying to stay alive in a hostile world?
I don't worry about Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, waking up some morning and deciding to eliminate Phoenix. What I do concerned about, though, is that in about a year's time, they will be confident in their arsenal. They will use it to blackmail the United States to break our mutual defense treaty with South Korea and therefore to get our 28,500 service personnel off the peninsula. And then they're going to try to destroy the South Korean state because at the core of the North Korean regime is the sense that they must reunify the Korean state. And so therefore, they are going to undertake actions that are going to be risky and I believe extremely dangerous, and ones which we will oppose, not only for ourselves, but for our friends and allies. And that's where you have the real risk of miscalculation. Not today, but when the North Koreans feel that they can actually do what Vladimir Putin did in August 2014, and that is to use his nuclear arsenal for blackmail. There it was, the Baltics. There was no pushback. I'm sure Kim Jong-un heard that and decided that he could try that as well, of course, in a different context.
Gordon Chang, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
Bruce Ackerman is with us. He is a professor of law and political science at Yale University. Oh, he's not with us. Let me go back to Julian Borger, who is with us. And thank you for being with us. Very interesting comments from Gordon Chang that the real problem is down the road, not immediately. What other arenas are there where this could be worked out besides the United Nations? What are the prospects now of any kind of diplomatic conversations between the U.S. and North Korea? We had them at one point during the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I would say, well, first of all, I think there may be have an issue with the premise that Kim Jong-un has backed down. If you look at the statement, he didn't really back down. He said he'd reviewed the plans to launch this salvo at Guam and that he would watch a little more what the U.S. did. And that has been the position all along, unlike previous U.S. North Korean missile test. The door has been left open for the U.S. to prevent this one, depending on what it does. And the North Koreans have been fairly precise in their signaling that what really annoys them are the overflights of B-1B heavy bombers based in Guam, flying over South Korea very close to the North Korean border, and they have concerns about the upcoming military exercises that start next week involving U.S. and South Korean forces, which have been a long-term bugbear for the North Koreans. But they've been precise about the B-1B overflights. But in doing so, they've left a door opening for possibly some kind of confidence-building measures that could be discussed in the New York Channel, that's the, where diplomats from the two countries have met at the UN, about modifications both sides can make to what they do. For example, it is possible that B-1B flights could be stepped down or not fly so close to the border in response to the North Koreans not firing these missiles at Guam. I mean, the messaging from Pyongyang is fairly clear that they are ready to talk about the conditions in which this missile salvo at Guam would go ahead or not.
Well, thanks for clarifying that. It's easy to say that Kim Jong-un has backed away because the idea was that he might let fly at Guam sometime today or tomorrow, and clearly he's not doing that. But if he did send those missiles toward Guam, hasn't the U.S. said that that would be, as I think one of the top generals put it, time to go ahead for us.
Well, the Secretary General,
game on,
Defense,
I think.
Secretary. Yeah. Yeah, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said that if a missile was heading towards Guam territory, the island itself, then they would take that missile out, and that would be a state of war. He was, clear. The question is, which he left open, is what if they splashed down in the seas around Guam? Then he said that was for a matter for the president to decide, presumably in advance, what to do if they are going to land, as Pyongyang says, 30 or 40 kilometers off the coast. How do you respond to that? And that is a more nuanced question. It's not necessarily the beginning of a war. But if they go astray, or if the real attention is to hit Guam itself, then that is another question. And then that would be a state of war, as the Defense Secretary made clear.
Julian Borger, once again, World Affairs Editor for The Guardian. Bruce Ackerman is with us now, and I'm glad that that's the case. He's a professor of law and political science at Yale University. And Bruce Ackerman, good to have you back as always.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. We heard earlier from Leon Panetta that he's concerned because the United States is talking in a way that it never has done before in the voice of President Trump, making the kinds of threats that he has. That has raised the question of, what do we do if he were to decide at some point that he did want to use nuclear weapons? Is there a way that that could be stopped, or does he have complete authority, given the enactments of Congress in 1973, to just go ahead and use the nuclear weapons?
President Trump does not have the authority. He's acting just the way Richard Nixon acted in 1971, 72, and 73, and asserted that he could unilaterally make war. And it's precisely this claim that Congress, over Nixon's veto, repudiated and asserted its constitutional right, power, as the Constitution says, to declare war. Moreover, Congress was aware of its habit of going on vacation and was explicitly concerned with the situation that we're seeing before us right now. That is, that Trump is using the fact that Congress is on vacation to unilaterally create the prospect of imminent hostilities, to quote the statute. And the statute creates a special procedure. It says that 30 senators have to sign a petition and 131 representatives have to sign a petition demanding a special session of Congress to immediately meet and take appropriate steps. That means, and this is precisely what Congress should do right now. I'm very concerned that if Congress waits until it returns in the normal way on September 5th, I think it is, it's going to be overwhelmed by another domestic crisis. It has to prevent a government shutdown by the end of September, and it only has a very small number of days of business, and they're going to be wheeling and dealing there. This will create the impression that President Trump can do what he wants and make war when Congress has explicitly provided this procedure. So I very much believe that 30 senators, I hope some of them are hearing me as they drive to the beach or something like that, and 131 representatives join together to demand a special session. The statute also provides special procedures so as to prevent filibusters and any delaying tactics. There, in a plausible way, we could have Congress on the floor after 3 days of debate vote a resolution telling the president, for example, that he cannot make a first nuclear attack. Whatever else is considered reasonable and plausible. If Congress does not have a special session, it will be creating a precedent for further brinkmanship by the President of the United States over the next 3 years, and it will also be creating the impression around the world that the separation of powers that the Constitution sets up cannot restrain this erratic president, and that is terrible news
for the rest of the world. What about the staff of the Defense Department, particularly General Mattis, and in the White House itself? Is there any chance that the generals could resign, or that they could take some action and refuse to carry out the orders of the president, or would that simply be totally impossible for them to do?
Well, we have to make a distinction between the generals, people who used to be generals and are now Secretary of Defense or head of the chief of staff. They are civilian officials, and of course, if they're confronted with some fundamental breach of constitutional law, which is going on right now, I should insist, they should resign. There have been many cases where civilian officers of the United States, whatever their background, have resigned on principle. However, I do not believe that the general staff, the actual generals who are in charge with receiving orders, they should not should not think themselves authorized to defy the President of the United States. This is to go down the path of Latin America. We have seen time again and time after time generals refusing to obey civilian chiefs. However, you know, President Trump is President Trump. He is the chief of state. We have seen time after time generals saying, "I'm going to save the republic," defy the president of the Argentina or whatever. In that context, it would create a devastating precedent for the future.
Let me go back to Julian Borgin.
First and fundamental principle is that it's Congress's job to move quickly and decisively to establish to the country and to the world that the president does not have the unilateral authority to casually say, well, maybe we'll invade Venezuela. This is unacceptable.
Okay. Again, Bruce Ackerman, professor of law and political science, Yale University. Julian Borger, back to you at The Guardian, world affairs editor. Are the issues that Professor Ackerman raises of concern to other countries, particularly allies of the United States, are they looking at this as a constitutional crisis, as the professor is?
Yeah, I think they're looking at it with considerable alarm, because the question for them, for those governments in Europe and around the world, is who speaks for the U.S. government? Because over a period of time now, they've heard a very different message coming from President Trump as compared to Vice President Pence, Mattis, or Tillerson. Now, in Europe, they, in a way, they have that luxury. They can hear something from Trump and then weigh up what they've heard from the others. When it comes to nuclear brinksmanship in East Asia or anywhere, then that there isn't that luxury, because although the ability, the authority to declare war may not rest in the hands of the president in terms of the Constitution, he does have the ability, the physical ability, to get on the phone that has the nuclear codes to launch a nuclear strike. Without anyone being able to prevent him. And it's possible that the Congress could convene after that, but of course that would be too late. And so that is the number one concern, I would say, of other governments in a situation like this.
Professor Ackerman, if in fact there were a nuclear attack against the United States, the president would have a few very short time, as just indicated, to respond to that. How would it be possible to have a more complicated arrangement than we have now? You certainly couldn't have Congress coming in with 30 senators and 131 representatives to make a decision like that in 4 or 5 minutes.
Absolutely right. The War Powers Resolution gives the president the right to order a counterattack when, after the an attack on the United States or its army or its territories occurs. But this moment in which both sides are pausing on the brink of nuclear disaster is precisely the moment when Congress should intervene proactively and say, look, President Trump, this is what you cannot do, and this is what you can do. And mind you, I might have misspoken, Warren, but when 131 representatives and 30 senators sign this petition, and I think that there are more than enough on a bipartisan basis who would do so, the entire Congress has to come back to Washington.
Okay.
Immediately. To set down guidelines and make it clear that President Trump does not have the authority that he's asserting.
All right. Now, that's all the time we have for this segment of our program. And I want to thank you both for being with us. Bruce Ackerman, again, professor of law, political science at Yale University. Julian Borger, world affairs editor for The Guardian. Thanks to our earlier guest, Gordon Chang, and Leon Panetta as well. In a moment, Doxing Nazis on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney here with today's Talking Point. When a picture of him carrying a torch this weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, turned up on the Twitter account, hashtag yes, you're a racist, a cook at a hot dog restaurant in Berkeley, California, was fired. Two universities condemned white supremacy after students were identified the same way. Those are examples of the power of doxing, which Daryl Lamont Jenkins has been doing for 17 years, starting long before Twitter existed. He is executive director of One People's Project. Daryl Lamont Jenkins, welcome to our program.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
A lot of people call this naming and shaming. You don't like that characterization. Why not?
Well, I look at it this way. I have been a journalist almost all my life. That is my vocation. So when I put this information out, it's basically just to inform the public as to who's who or what's what. I mean, I don't have a problem with anyone doing any of this, but I think we should basically focus on primarily the fact that we are trying to protect ourselves by letting people know who it is that are trying to do us harm. And that's the focus of it, at least for One People's Project.
Do you try to talk directly to some of the people you identify?
Oh, quite a bit, quite a bit, quite often. I think that you do have to keep that open door policy there because we are still dealing with human beings. I mean, no matter how bad somebody may be, they still are just simply misguided individuals. That doesn't mean that they are allowed to continue to do what they do. I mean, as we've seen in this past Saturday, they can still do you harm and you still have to protect yourself. But if you have the opportunity to talk and try to get them to turn around and change their lives, by all means, take that opportunity. But if that opportunity doesn't present itself, you got to do what you got to do. That's the deal.
Have you, by identifying people in this way, managed to get them fired or prevented from taking positions of power?
Indeed, indeed. I mean, today it was a hot dog vendor, but with us, we have ended up getting people ousted from their positions as prosecutors in upstate New York. We've kept a person from becoming a judge in Connecticut. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, basically, outing people prevents them from growing and getting themselves into a position that can hurt us even more. I think about the fact that the Nazi that everybody knows now, Richard Spencer, he was somebody who was going to try to be a big player in Washington politics. He probably wanted to be a congressman, probably wanted to be a senator or a governor. But since we had been going after him since 2006, that was a little hard for him to do if people recognize him as being a white supremacist. So now all he is a carnival barker.
Tell us how you managed to get the prosecutor in upstate New York and the judge in Connecticut removed from those offices or prevented from taking them.
Well, in the case of the judge, I can tell you right now, she was actually running to become a judge. And we knew her husband was involved with an organization called the National Alliance and was very active. His name was Robert Freeman. And we just basically wrote about him. And when we found out that she was, and we had already been writing about him, and when we found out that she was running for office, we contacted, and this was in the Democratic primary, I need to stress that one. We basically just contacted the opposition, her opposition, and said, this is the situation with her. And when they confronted her and when the local media in Connecticut was confronting her, she basically admitted to everything, and that just put the kibosh on any possibility okay. of winning. So that's how that happened. The prosecutor in upstate New York, that was kind of indirect when it comes to us, because what happened was we was going after a conference called the American Renaissance Conference. It was basically a gathering of politically connected white supremacists in Washington, D.C. And this was back in 2006. We basically sounded the alarm about that particular conference and that there was going to be a protest against it. The local media came out, interviewed people that were attending the conference. This person was one of them. His employers in upstate New York found out about it, and that was the end of his career.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You go to these events. You were in Charlottesville over the weekend. You are an African-American man. You go in, you take pictures. How difficult is that for you, and how challenging? And tell us what that experience is like.
Well, it's really interesting because it's kind of easy for me. But then again, I've been doing this kind of work for 30 years. Most of that time, I was just basically learning about who they were and how they operated. When One People's Project was formed in 2000, it was all online. And basically, no one knew who I was, and whenever they would see me mulling about the neo-Nazis, they thought I was a black nationalist or what have you, because for some strange reason, they think that they have some sort of kinship with them, and I just played that. And then after a while, you know, I was able to gather all the information that I needed, blow it up all over onepeoplesproject.com. And then they realized, no, I'm not a nationalist. I'm the enemy. And that's what made it hard. But by that time, it was too late. I was pretty much on my way. And just documenting people left and right. And they don't make it hard for me to find the information if you know where to look and if you know how to talk to the right people.
There have been people, though, who have misidentified folks who were not at the Charlottesville rally. That happened over the weekend, and at least one person was made absolutely miserable, even though he was 1,000
yes.
miles away. How worried are you about that? How likely are you to do the same thing and make a mistake that could really ruin somebody's life?
Well, you do have to be careful, and I stress that among anybody that's going to be doing this kind of thing. As I said, my vocation is as a journalist, which means you have to make sure that all your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed. You have to make sure that you are factual. Otherwise, you're going to get zapped if you're not if you put something out there that ends up hurting somebody. You know that as a journalist. I know that as a journalist and an activist. So we just basically make sure second confirmations are key. We just make sure that we have the information and it is solid.
If it's not, we're not
going to put it out there. That's that simple.
Did you recognize familiar faces in Charlottesville?
Oh, it was a who's who. It was a who's who. It was at the point I was talking to somebody on my way down to the studio about a person that I didn't even know was there until today. And my response was, who wasn't there? I mean, there was people like David Duke. Obviously, everybody knows him. The person that I was referring to was Tom Robb of the Knights in Harrison, Arkansas. Billy Roper, who was an associate of Tom Robb, was there. I've seen members of old neo-Nazi crews that I used to hassle all the time. I mean, the list will go on. I don't think we have enough time to run down the names. And I'll bring up names that no one's ever heard of before, and I don't think that's necessarily fair to y'all. So the truth of the matter is I saw pretty much.
But these are old-timers.
We're hearing that younger
people now are getting involved in all of this. Did you find that to be the case, too?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, it was a case of a lot of times I saw a lot of the old guard that I hadn't seen being active in a long, long time. But in addition to that, I saw a lot of young folks that were coming in as well. I think that's basically just a new phenomenon because there was some really major efforts being waged in order to make that happen over the past 2 years. And that's why I always have to stress whenever I'm talking to people in the media, whenever I'm talking to these particular individuals, that, look, you're in your 20s. You're just starting out in life. This is not the direction you want to go in. Okay. If you do not want to see what happens when you're in your 30s or 40s, get out of this now. Basically, what happened in Charlottesville is they doxed themselves. And they are going to have to live with what they did in Charlottesville for the rest of their lives.
We're going to have to stop right there. Darryl Lamont Jenkins, executive director of the One People's Project, founded to research and report on a who's who among American right-wing hate groups. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you. I'm glad you had me here. Thank you.
I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.